Thank you, Jonga Kandemir. Good evening, Zimbabwe. You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America on Tuesday, February 9th, 2016. And as usual, we'd like to thank you for joining us live from Washington. This is Chris Gande.
And I'm Marvelous Mhlanga Nyahuye.
Here are our top stories this evening.
One of the four accused in the bombing at President Robert Mugabe's dairy farm to serve jail time for the crime.
Obviously, we are in pain about it, but we've seen that the judgment is considered his plight as well. I think he showed a lot of contrition.
Politburo meeting tomorrow promises to be a spectacle as alleged factions plan mass demonstrations.
If your question is, are we going to block them? We are currently consulting because, you see, they are trying to use a strategy whereby they are going to cause our women fight war veterans.
The family of missing activist Itai Dzamara continues to pine for him while remaining hopeful of his return 11 months after his disappearance.
My children are asking a lot of questions about their father every day. They ask about their father and it really pains me.
For these stories and much more, stay tuned.
Opposition leader Owen Kuchata of the Zimbabwe People's Front was today slapped with two separate sentences after pleading guilty to attempting to bomb the First Family's Alpha and Omega dairy farm in Mazowe and money laundering. Iwin Chifera has more details from Harare.
Harare magistrate Hosea Mujaya convicted Kuchata on his own guilt plea and sentenced him to 9 years on the first account of terrorism, but suspended 1 year of the sentence on condition he does not commit a similar offence in 5 years on the second count of money laundering arising from the money raised for buying equipment to make petrol bombs. Mujaya sentenced Kuchata to 2 years, with 1 year of the sentence set to run concurrently with the sentence for count one, while terrorism could carry maximum life sentence and the money laundering maximum 35 years, the magistrate said Kuchata was a first offender and had shown contrition by asking for forgiveness. Kuchata earlier told the court he did not want to remove President Robert Mugabe from power, but simply wanted to bomb the farm so that the president could feel the pain Zimbabweans are experiencing as a result of house demolitions in Harare. But Magistrate Mujaya said Kuchata's method of communication was wrong and there were better ways of communicating with political opponents. He said the method Kuchata wanted to use could be expected in countries like Afghanistan. Kuchata's wife, Joylene, said though the sentence was tough, the family was unlikely to appeal against the ruling and sentence. Another family relative, Cosmos Musakanda, confirmed there were no plans to appeal the sentence at the moment.
Obviously, we are in pain about it, but we've seen that the judgment is considered his plight as well. I think he showed a lot of contrition, and the judge took note of that. And we are happy at least they understood him in a way.
Kuchata was jointly charged with Solomon Makumbe, Silas Fupa, and Boman Gwenya, all of whom have military connections. The three are due in court next week. The case has sucked in Prosecutor General Johannes Tomana, who was arrested for withdrawing charges against Makumbe and Fupa before plea so that they could become state witnesses in the matter. Tomana is now facing charges of abusing his office and is currently out of jail after posting $1,000 bail. Harare resident Simon Mare said the sentence was fair given that the accused had not wasted the court's time. But Harare lawyer and spokesperson of the People's Democratic Party, Jacob Mafume, said the sentence was too harsh and urged the Kuchata family to appeal the sentence.
I'm still trying to look at where the terrorism and other high-sounding serious car crimes is coming from. And I think that the sentence in itself is excessive. This was a private property. It has nothing to do with the state. The attempt was thwarted. There was nothing that was bent, not even a single grass was bent.
The case will be reviewed by a High Court judge in the next 7 days. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Reports of growing tension in the ruling ZANU-PF party have reached fever pitch levels today amid reports that buses loaded with demonstrators will be heading to Harare Wednesday for the weekly Politburo meeting. According to the Herald, members of the party's Women's League and National Commissar Sevia Kasukuwere are organizing demonstrations against Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, Chairman Christopher Mutswangwa of the Zimbabwe National Liberation War Veterans Association, and also Presidential Spokesperson George Charamba. Over the past weeks, words have been exchanged between the various groups, most notably between Mutswangwa and Education Minister Jonathan Moyo. An estimated crowd of about 10,000 is expected, according to the Herald.
If your question is, are we going to block them? We are currently consulting because, you see, they are trying to use a strategy whereby they are going to cause our women fight war veterans. They would do that because as they are coming, they have not been told exactly what they are coming for. And war veterans now cannot be seen to be fighting their own supporters. And in any case, you see, they are coming from rural areas. That's where war veterans are. And we are not going to cause any problems between our supporters and the war veterans.
But Mr. Matemadanda, are there no other means to talk to the other group in the party so that there won't be any sniping at each other and calling each other names?
Well, other means, this is what we are talking about, because they had tried to cause a physical conflict between war veterans and the Women's League. And because, war veterans are strategists, they are not going to be drawn into that. Talking about it or over it, tomorrow the president is going to preside over a Politburo meeting, and we are looking forward to seeing solutions being proffered towards these problems. And maybe we might see sanity from there onwards.
That was Zimbabwe National Liberation War Veterans Association Secretary General Victor Mutemadanda speaking there with Studio 7's Blessing Zulu from Harare.
The family of human rights activist Itai Zamara today pleaded with his abductors to release him, saying they believe he is still alive, though he's been missing since last March. Many believe Zamara, who was abducted by suspected state operatives, was targeted for his Occupy Africa Unity Square campaign that urged President Robert Mugabe to step down. The European Union, meanwhile, says it is disappointed and concerned about the lack of progress by the government in searching for the journalist come activist. In a brief statement, the EU called on, quote-unquote, authorities to ensure that justice is served. Ordinary Zimbabweans, politicians and activists joined the Zamara family today at the Africa Unity Square to pray for Itai's safe and immediate return. Zamara's wife, Shefra, tells reporter Tatenda Gumbo that she is still hopeful.
Today it marks 11 months since my husband was abducted. And it's very, very sad for us, because we still don't know where the child is.
How are the children doing? Last time we spoke to you, you said that they had been asking where their father is. How are they doing now?
They are still asking. And you can see that the kids really miss their father. They are still asking.
And how are things for you financially? Are you still receiving any assistance from well-wishers?
For the meantime, we are not receiving anything, but the mothers are really supporting us.
And as we look today, 11 months, what's your message to those out there listening about the disappearance of your husband? What do you say to them?
For those listening, I'd like to say, for the Zimbabweans, let's stand up and say no to abduction. And for those who abducted my husband, I just want to say, please, release inside Zamara. These two little kids still want their father in love, and I still want my husband.
That was the wife of Itai Zamara, Shifra, speaking with Studio 7's Tatenda Gumbo. Speaking with reporter Ntungamili Nkomo, Zamara's brother Patson echoed his sister-in-law's sentiments.
In as much as we are going through the pain and the grief, we are also still holding on to hope, and we are also looking forward to meeting, in the case of Shifra, her husband and the kids, the son and Nyasha, their father. And as a family, luckily, we are also still hoping and holding on to the belief that someday and hopefully soon we're going to meet and reunite with his guys.
But given the time period that has elapsed, are you still really hopeful that he might be still alive someplace out there?
Yeah, definitely. We still hold on to hope. We have had testimonies of people who are abducted by the same regime, by the same security agencies, who are abducted for close to 8 months, and nobody knew where they were. But they're still with us today. Eventually, they were released. And so we do believe that God can still do it, even with his time.
That was Itai Zamara's brother, Patson, on the line with reporter Ntungamili Nkomo from Harare. Meanwhile, the Zamara family says it is planning to meet shortly with the Justice Minister and Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa over the issue. Ntungamili Nkomo and Tatenda Gumbo will be discussing Zamara during the connection on Live Talk at 8:30 p.m., so don't forget to join them.
The Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights says it is appalled by the suspension of the leaders of the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association from active duty over alleged frivolous and trumped-up charges. The Health Service Board on the 5th of February issued a notice of suspension to Dr. F. Manyere, Dr. Edson Makoni, and Dr. Rusununguko Kanyongo, alleging that the three doctors committed an act of misconduct for having allegedly incited fellow doctors in Zimbabwe to engage in industrial action in October 2014. The doctor's chairperson, Dr. Rutendo Bonde, tells Studio 7's Blessing Zulu that the suspension is disturbing.
I'm aware of this issue, and I feel that it's rather heavy-handed of the employer, given that the conditions and the objectives of the industrial action by the hospital doctors was not a malicious class action by them as a collective, but it was an aspiration to make the country live up to the constitution, which says that the right to health care is a right for all. And central to that is the conditions, one, within the institution, and the remuneration of those people who are providing services.
Dr. Bonde, what is the way forward?
You know, there is really need for a collective approach here to look at what are the needs of the country as a whole. And we need to start looking and thinking outside the box at where do we get resources? Because we know that the fiscal space is contracted at the moment, and there are so many competing priorities for the state.
That was the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights chairperson, Dr. Rutendo Bonde, speaking there with Studio 7's Blessing Zulu from Harare.
Here Here in the United States, the race for the November presidential elections is in full swing, and today candidates for both the Republican and Democratic parties are in New Hampshire, campaigning to be the party's chosen nominees. On the Republican ticket, early results indicate that businessman Donald Trump is leading, while on the Democratic ticket, early results show Bernie Sanders leading Hillary Clinton.
We now turn to Central Africa reporter Thomas Kamilindi, who is in New Hampshire, for an update. Hi, Thomas. Tell us what's happening in New Hampshire today.
Hi. The people of New Hampshire are showing there are many, many, many in this poll station called Londonderry High School. It's the biggest poll station of the state, I heard. So people are excited. They are coming with their IDs. They check with the IDs and they get the paper and they go to vote and they cast their ballot.
Thomas, this particular election is being described as very important. Can you explain to us why?
It is because here in New Hampshire, 40% and then more of that are independent. So they can vote either for Democrats, either for Republicans. So this is a huge number of people who can make the difference. This is why here in New Hampshire, the election is very important.
Yes, Thomas, we have heard so far that the polls that had been predicted that Hillary Clinton was going to lose to Bernie Sanders and on the Democratic side, and on the Republican side that businessman Mr. Trump is leading. Do you see a change in this scenario?
Right now, it's not clear yet. So we can't say who is going to win. And as you said, it's unpredictable. Because those 40% of people who are independent, as I said, can make the difference. So we have to wait at 8 p.m. to know what is going on.
Thank you very much, Thomas Kamilindi, for joining us from the African Central African Desk, but reporting for us there from New Hampshire. You have a great evening.
You are welcome.
Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, there are many eligible voters from Zimbabwe who are paying close attention to the elections here in the United States. Dr. Moses Romano, the chairman of the Education Department at Mellon University in Canton, Ohio, speaks to Studio 7 on what the country can learn from the voting process currently underway in New Hampshire.
Zimbabwe has many more lessons and insights to learn from the current primaries that are being held in New Hampshire. The electorate are given the free will to choose the candidate who appeals to them the most, and there are no cases of violence. There are no cases of intimidation. I think that is something that we have to learn as a young nation in Zimbabwe, that let the people choose the candidate of their choice and we move forward.
Who would you say have been the favorites, judging from what we've seen happening?
I think Mr. Trump could be the favorite. This is a big television personality. So he has been using his connection. Times you could say very controversial issues, and those controversial issues were able to put him on a map, and that is maybe a marketing strategy or a campaign strategy that he used in order to sell his ideas to the electorate. I am positive that he could be able to win because his message of prosperity to many people that the United States could become once more vibrant, I think this resonates quite well with the electorate.
And the Democrats?
I think Mrs. Hillary Clinton could be the favorite candidate, and I think she might win.
That was Dr. Moses Romano, the chairman of the Education Department at Mellon University here in the United States in Canton, Ohio.
But first, let's take a look at regional and international news.
The U.S. spy chief told Congress Tuesday that North Korea has restarted a plutonium reactor that could provide fuel for nuclear weapons.
Nigeria has more people and more money than any other country in Africa, with much of its wealth coming from one industry, oil.
And the United Nations warned on Tuesday that if pro-government forces in Syria succeed in encircling the city of Aleppo, up to 300,000 people could be cut off from humanitarian aid.
You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America in Washington.
Some Zimbabwean youth are bemoaning the lack of political will to address the political and socio-economic crisis engulfing the country. As Thomas Chiripatsi reports from Harare, unemployment and poverty levels are rising.
The future looks bleak for most young people in Zimbabwe, despite a projected economic growth of 2.7 this year. The economy registered a marginal 1.5% growth in 2015 due to lack of foreign direct investment, fears over the country's indigenization program, and related issues. Against this background, some Zimbabwean youth say they are failing to get formal jobs as the economy appears to be shrinking fast. One of the affected people is Joanna Mamombe, a former student of the University of Zimbabwe who graduated last year and is still looking for a formal job. Mamombe says her hopes of fulfilling her dreams now seem to be shattered, adding that only a few youths with links to some top government officials are getting the few available jobs.
It's very sad that the government of today, anything that is happening now, it's partisan. Especially considering on the funds that are being allocated to the youth, you find that if you are not aligned to their political party, definitely you not get any cent from the youth fund. So whether you're from the church, an opposition party, you will not get that funding unless you are correctly aligned to their political party.
Another unemployed youth, Philip Jongwe, says he is disappointed that government is not prioritizing funding education and skills provision.
Personally, I am a disgruntled somebody when it comes to the respect of the youth in Zimbabwe. It's so regrettable that the government of Zimbabwe, they actually forget that the youth are integral stakeholders in as far as the development of each and every nation is concerned. Unfortunately, the government of Zimbabwe, which is purely made of ZANU-PF, they do not even respect the youth. If you go to the youth leaders of ZANU-PF, they are far from being youth. So unfortunate to strongly fight for the respect of the youth because they are also a national objective.
Peaceful protests in Zimbabwe are normally blocked by police, a feared arm of the state. The suppression of such protests is not generating jobs at all. Tariro Senderai, who works for Organizing Zimbabwe, a non-governmental organization focusing on youth development, argues that the government is only good at allegedly oppressing young people instead of creating various opportunities for them. Senderai says Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa only allocated a paltry $10 million towards youth development in his 2016 national budget, and this appears to be hindering their empowerment.
Well, looking at the national budget that was proposed by our Honourable Minister Patrick Chinamasa on the 27th of November, it would appear as though most of it is being gobbled up on expenditures, because Vangawa proposed about $4 billion and $3.6 billion is going to expenses, and then what remains for development? In as much as with what remains for development, how much even remains from that little that remains for the young people to develop themselves? I just feel as though a lot of thought should be put into the national budget, and considering that young people consist of 68% of the national population, we need to be considered in a massive way in terms of investment as well.
Former student leader Obey Stole agrees, noting that the current political leadership in Zimbabwe has no political will to transform the lives of youths.
When the government comes up with some programs, it eliminates or it separates the youth from taking part within those initiatives. Because even if you take the national objective and the first sections of the constitution, the youth are taken as the priority. They are one of the national objectives, among the main national objectives. But when it comes to the operation on ground, there's no respect at all.
Fortune Munyonga, youth president of the Renewal Democrats of Zimbabwe, says Mr. Mugabe is failing to deliver the jobs his party promised in 2013. He says instead, hundreds of companies have shut down following the disputed polls.
For the exclusion of the opposition parties in this government thing, which will maybe before the end of the year, we are going to hand over the petition, fighting for our space. Fighting for our rights as Zimbabwean youth.
For its part, the government, through Youth and Indigenization Minister Patrick Juao, who is Mr. Mugabe's nephew, says the country is doing all it can to improve the lives of youth in Zimbabwe. Juao is shifting some of the blame to ZANU-PF youth who are failing to repay loans created under youth development programs to cater for the needy. He says defaulters should be punished as they are crippling black empowerment programs.
Currently, about $5.1 million plus $1.7, which makes it $6.8 million, that has been locked up by those that are not paying back.
Political and social commentator David Masunda says young people are leaving the country in large numbers to seek greener pastures in neighboring nations like South Africa, Botswana and Namibia, as Mr. Mugabe's government is failing to revive the crumbling and collapsed industries capable of creating jobs.
Universities and technical colleges are churning out youths almost every day, but industry is on its knees, there's no employment, and most of them now are now being forced to join the informal sector, even when they've got master's degrees or even high technical qualifications. So the future for them is not really that bright. That's why most of them are now trying as much as possible to leave the country, either for South Africa or for greener pastures anywhere in the world.
Statistics show that more than 85% of the country's population is unemployed, though official figures are pegged at almost 11%. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Salah Farah, a Muslim teacher in Kenya who defied the sectarian divisions sought by extremists, died recently in a hospital in Nairobi. Mr. Farah was shot in December when the bus he and others were riding on in northeastern Kenya was attacked by Al-Shabaab terrorists. After firing on and then boarding the bus, the terrorists demanded the passengers separate into groups, Muslims on one side, Christians on the other. Similar demands by Al-Shabaab gunmen during other attacks have resulted in the deaths of scores of Christians. But instead of obeying the terrorists, the Muslim passengers on the bus, among them Mr. Farah, refused. Instead, they tried to hide the Christians, reportedly giving them some pieces of their clothing so that they could not be easily identified. The passengers also told the terrorists to kill every one of them, or to leave them all alone. The gunmen took off, but not before firing shots that killed two people and injured three others, including Mr. Farah. Mr. Farah spent weeks in the hospital before succumbing to his injuries. He gave interviews calling for peace and unity. In an interview with the Voice of America, Mr. Farah said, "We are brothers. It's only the religion that is the difference. So I ask my brother Muslims to take care of the Christians, so that the Christians also take care of us. And let us help one another, and let us live together peacefully." Salah Farah is a hero. Not only did he risk his life to protect others, his actions throw into stark contrast the difference in values between a devout Muslim like Farah and the terrorists who distort Islam, using religious differences as a weapon to gain power and control. In his recent visit to an American mosque in Baltimore, President Barack Obama noted that the vast majority of Muslims embrace their religion as a source of peace. It is a small fraction which propagates a perverted interpretation of Islam. What must be done in the face of this perversion? President Obama asked. His answer is one that Salah Farah would recognize, because he lived it. "When others are trying to divide us along lines of religion or sect," said President Obama, "we have to reaffirm that most fundamental of truths. We are all God's children. We're all born with inherent dignity. Our faith summons us to embrace our common humanity."
And now a quick recap of today's top stories. One of the four accused in the bombing at President Robert Mugabe's dairy farm is to serve jail time for the crime.
And the Politburo meeting tomorrow promises to be a spectacular one as alleged functions plan mass demonstrations.
That's all we had for you tonight. My name is Chris Gande. Good night, Zimbabwe.
And I'm Marvelous Mhlanga Nyahuye, wishing you a pleasant evening and a very good night.